John Nakashiba left Japan in 1889 at the age of 16. Escaping famine and looking for adventure, he signed on as a cabin boy and boarded a steamer for America. But he had no English, and while temporarily docking in Melbourne, he thought he was already in the United States, so he got off the ship. And that's how John Nakashiba came to Australia. He first followed other new arrivals to the goldfields at Ballarat, but by the turn of the century, he'd moved to North Queensland and was doing very well in the pearling business, and there he married an Australian woman. But John's world changed very abruptly when Japan entered the Second World War, and although by then he'd been in Australia for over 50 years, he and his family were arrested and interned. Producer Ros Bluett hears about the war from a Japanese-Australian's perspective.
In 1941, when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, John Nakashiba had been in Australia for nearly half a century. He was doing well for his young family, servicing the local pearling industry in the waters around Queensland and the Northern Territory. And due to his fluent English and knowledge of the waters, he worked closely with the Japanese seamen in the area. But when Japan entered the war, John Nakashiba suddenly realized he may have been misled by these so-called fishermen. His elder daughter Mary is now 89. She spoke with me about the dramatic impact of the war and her memories of early family life. In particular, her father's love of music.
My father could actually sing. He loved to sing. I can remember the songs that Dad used to sing to us. And he could keep in tune, what's more. Oh, yeah, he sang us all sorts of songs. I can't remember them all, but he was always singing songs.
When Mary was almost four, the Nakashibas moved to Darwin. It was a fledgling town of only 1,500 people and a truly multicultural society. Mary was the only one of her siblings that looked Japanese. But in Darwin, she says, no one noticed. She loved it there.
Really, you can say that Darwin is my hometown. And look, I could kiss the ground whenever I go there. I love it. You know, if ever you grew up in Darwin, you could never, ever feel that your home was anywhere else but the Northern Territory. And the kids were free. You know, we had Greek kids. We had a big Chinese community. A lot of Russian kids, part Aborigines, and everybody was different. And there was probably somebody of every nationality. They all came to the schools. All the time that we were in Darwin, it was a happy time for our family. As a matter of fact, because of the multicultural society that we lived in, it was a perfect place. And all the Darwin kids were happy.
While the kids played and got up to mischief, John Nakashiba's pearling business thrived. Mary's father's excellent command of English had him translating for the Australian Navy, as well as securing supplies for Japanese seamen.
So Dad was the agent for the overseas pearlers, but he was also doing all the paperwork for all the indentured labourers. They used to come out from, I don't know where, but somewhere in Japan, or maybe the islands, and they used to work for the season, but they had to go home in the monsoon season because they didn't do the pearling then. And that was what he did until the war.
During the latter part of the 1930s, John Nakashiba also assisted Japanese fishing fleets with mapping and navigation of the local waters, a decision that would later plague him. Family leisure time in Darwin was spent singing and socialising with the local church communities who welcomed everyone.
He'd go to the Anglican church in the morning, and then in the evening he'd say, I feel like good singing tonight, let's go to the Methodist. And they had really good rousing songs like, you know, "He's the Lily of the Valley, the Bright and Morning Star," all really jazzy songs, and he loved that. The Methodists could sing the best, he reckoned. He loved music, and if it wasn't the Methodists, sometimes he'd go to the Presbyterian for preaching, but then he'd say, "I think we go to benediction," because he used to love all the songs in Latin. It was the music, really, I think, that drew him. Before the war, it was a very happy time in our family.
In her teenage years, Mary went to a Catholic boarding school in Brisbane. And it was during the boat trip back to Darwin for the holidays when she heard that America had just been attacked by the Japanese. She was 15.
I was coming home in 1941 and the news came over the radio that Pearl Harbor was bombed. Well, I didn't know what that meant because when you're in a boarding school, particularly a convent, you do not get any access to papers. You don't know what's happening. It's like being in an enclosed order. So the chief steward came along and took me along, and there was a policeman there, and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "I'm arresting you." And I said, "What have I done?" And they said, "We're at war with Japan, and your mother and father have been taken, and all your family." And they were clearly very, very embarrassed. And well, look, I was stunned, to tell you the truth. I mean, I was absolutely stunned. My blood turned to water. It was just such a shock. And I think that all our family were totally in shock. And my father was in a catatonic state for months and months. When Mum was arrested in Darwin, after she went to the initial holding camp, they said, "You are free to go, you're an Australian citizen." She said, "I will not leave my family." She said, "Where my family goes, I go."
But she did have to leave her husband. Mary's mother, brother and younger sister were taken to Adelaide River holding camp, while Mary was driven there straight from the school boat.
Two soldiers came and took me to Adelaide River about 100 miles away. Barbed wire everywhere, and all the indentured labourers, the pearlers, they were in another area. But not just Japanese, we had people that had nothing to do with Japanese, but they were just picked up because there was panic. See, nobody expected the war, and everybody was panic-stricken, particularly in those northern towns, Broome, Darwin, Thursday Island, Cairns.
And 2 months later, in February 1942, when Singapore fell to the Japanese and Darwin was bombed, the women and children from the holding camps were transferred to boats heading south.
We were all put onto the Zelandia, which was a coastal steamer, and all of the indentured labourers in the hold. It was just like a hellhole for them, but we were in steerage. We were landed in Sydney. My brother then was taken from us and sent with the indentured labourers down to Hay. And he was only 17. And my mother protested, but he had to go.
Fear began to take hold in Australia as harrowing accounts about the fate of Allied soldiers in Asia spread through the community.
There were thousands of Australians killed in Malaya. And then, of course, they were all prisoners of war. And they were on the Burma Railroad and Changi Jail. And it was just absolutely terrible. This is something that sort of... my father couldn't take it. He was like a zombie. He had a nervous breakdown and he never really fully recovered. He was an Australian. He'd never gone back. And it was such a shock to him because he worked for the Navy. He was a translator for the Navy. And so he didn't expect this. I mean, nobody in Australia really expected that Darwin was going to be bombed. And when Darwin was bombed, it was just a huge shock.
In Sydney, after saying goodbye to her brother, Mary and her mother and sister were put on the train to Tatura internment camp in Victoria.
When we arrived in the camp, we had people from Papua New Guinea already there. We had people from New Caledonia, all the Japanese and the part Japanese and some people that weren't even Japanese. And they also had Germans, and they were sent out from Britain. See, Australia was sort of like a holding camp for people. And they all were all sent out from Britain because some of them were Jews, but they didn't quite trust them, you see. It's a matter of terminology, I suppose, because I know that when I got our papers from the archives, we were classed as POW too. We were brought up as Australians. We didn't know any other culture. And of course, with the Japanese culture, it's very hierarchical, and also we didn't understand it. And Mum, particularly, she had a hard time. We couldn't speak Japanese. We didn't know the culture. We didn't know how to behave. We didn't know how to bow. We would not bow to the rising sun. And so we were on the outer anyway because we weren't full Japanese. See, this is the thing. Then they kicked us out.
The Nakashibas were then transferred to another compound. Although still surrounded by barbed wire, life got a little better.
Well, the Indonesian camp that we were sent to, they were a totally different type of people. They were very friendly. They were not militaristic like the ones in the Camp A where we were kicked out from. And we had loads of Dutch women, Dutch kids, Indonesian kids. The lingua franca of that camp was Indonesian. It was a very peaceful sort of a camp, and there was a lot of singing. You know, they were very, very friendly, and they were very inclusive. That's where I learned to sing a whole lot of songs. Terangbulan, Terangbulan, di pinggir kali, buaya timbul di sanggalau mati. I can't sing really, but that tune was the tune of the national anthem of Selangor. And when I went up to Malaya to work, I heard that and I thought, Terang Bulan, but it had different words. But it was exactly the same tune.
While Mary and her mother and sister were finding life easier with the Indonesians, John Nakashiba was in a separate camp and not coping. The effects of the nervous breakdown that he'd experienced when first arrested were still playing out, and his physical health had also deteriorated.
He wanted to die. He wanted to die, and he felt this responsibility because he was in charge of the overseas pearling. And I remember that my mother said to me that he said, for ordinary seamen, those captains seemed to be very, very well educated. And he then realised that they must have been charting all of the waters north of Australia. And we were frequently on board these ships because he had to be responsible for seeing that they got provisions when they came to port and all the rest of it. And I think that he had an enormous burden of guilt. I think that any Australian Japanese that had been born there would have felt this. He could not reconcile himself to the fact that his people had committed all of these atrocities.
Meanwhile, after nearly 3 years in Tatura internment camp, it seemed that there might be a way out for Mary, her mother and her sister.
At the end of 1944, I was about to turn 18, and they felt that it was about that I should get out. And actually, I was becoming stir-crazy because I was prepared to jump that fence and just run. I couldn't stand it anymore.
So the Nakashima women were finally released. Mary's sister was going to finish her schooling, and her mother was to start work at a hostel. But Mary had her own plans.
We were met by the Anglican people down in Melbourne, and then Mum was the matron of the hostel, Anglican hostel, and I was there. By that time I turned 18, and Manpower said, OK, you can go up there and can fruit up at Shepparton and live in the hostel. But I had already decided I'd go nursing because I had wanted to be a surgeon, and I was took subjects so that I would go to university and study medicine. And so I thought, oh, well, next best thing, I'll be a nurse. And then I was working as a nurse on VE Day and VP Day. VP Day was victory in the Pacific. Melbourne went wild. Every city went wild on VP Day rather than VE Day, because VE Day was victory in Europe. But we still had the war in our backyard, so VP was the day when everybody went out and celebrated, because that meant that the war for us ended.
But despite peace, Mary's family and others with Japanese heritage continued to be ostracised.
Well, when the war was over, there was extreme hostility to the Japanese people. And it's totally understandable. I hated them too. There was terrible, terrible hatred when all of those guys that survived all of these atrocities came back. And there's still that lingering thing. Dad, of course, had to wait in the camp because they didn't release them all. But what happened was every Japanese that had no connection to Australia, no children left, or even some of them that did have children in Australia, they were sent back. We were very worried that my father might be sent back because we heard that they were sending them all back to Japan. My mother tried all she could to get him out. And the Anglican Church came to the rescue. The Anglican Church was absolutely fantastic. And there was a priest up at Kyneton, an Anglican priest, and he said, look, I'll have him. Send him here to me. So they sent Dad down to Kyneton, and he stayed there. And then the YMCA bought a big place up at Warburton. Beautiful. It was the last house on the road before the Donabuang Road right up to the summit. It was a place that had the most beautiful garden, and there was a creek running through, and all it needed was somebody that would keep that garden in order. And so Dad went there, and he was passionate about gardening. He loved gardening. When Mum and Dad were given this job in Warburton, it was the most wonderful thing that could have happened to them, because they were really, truly free and together again for the first time since war broke out. And Dad was happy there because he really, really loved flowers. And this was the first peaceful time that he had after the camp. And really, the people up at Warburton, you have no idea how wonderful they were. They were so totally accepting. So he was in charge of the garden. Mum was in charge of the hostel. A lot of the time, they were just the two of them together. And when Dad finally died, he died there, up there, and Mrs. Larkin came and laid him out for my mum. They were just marvellous. All of the people around. You couldn't have got better neighbours.
John Nakashima was fortunate to be able to stay in Warburton. He died there in 1949 at the age of 77. His daughter Mary continued her nursing, which took her to Malaysia under the Colombo Plan. She later wrote a book, Beyond Borders, about her family's experiences during the war and the turns her life has taken since then.
And on RN, you've been listening to Earshot. The Nakashibas story was produced by Ros Blewett with sound engineer Judy Rapley. And just over 4,000 Japanese civilians were interned in Australia during World War II. After Japan surrendered, all Japanese internees were forcibly repatriated unless they were Australian-born or had an Australian-born spouse.